Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gensius, a counseling faculty at Kent State University and a host for Circular Firing Squad. We've got five members, five questions, and five answers for each question. Questions are generated by each squad member and run from fundamental to frivolous. Let's do a roll call. Jen, you up first.
Hey, everyone. Jen Cook, Associate Professor, New England College.
Hi, everybody. Elliot Ingersoll, Professor of Counseling at Cleveland State University and host of Apply Topically. And 2 weeks back into work from a sabbatical with no dents in the fender.
Hi, Steph Martyr, doctoral candidate at Kent State University, practicing clinical mental health counselor and co-host of Grad School Deconstructed.
You can tell the doctoral candidates by the level of cognitive slippage due to sleep deprivation.
Thank you for that, Elliot. I appreciate it. It's a good cover.
Hey, everybody. Eric Perry, clinical faculty at Southern New Hampshire University.
And I've got the first question this week. What are you cynical about concerning higher education?
Well, I got to tell you, it was hard to narrow down to one because I do know that my brain goes a little cynical sometimes with higher education. I would say the biggest thing is this movement toward trying to operate higher education as a business, yet still operating in the mindset of a nonprofit, because technically most of us are all working in nonprofit higher ed. And what I mean by that is there's this business model that's been put in place that people who are not business people are having to institute, while the faculty are also still functioning as go get grant money, go get donations, because we need to run this in a bake sale format. And I don't see an end to this coming anytime soon, because we can't really figure out our identities in that. So we've got this idea of like, we need to run this as a business so that we're lean and we're making money and, you know, able to sustain for the future. But by the same token, you're saying this to a bunch of people who are running these institutions who do not know how to do that. So I don't see this going anywhere anytime soon, because it's been going on for quite some time, but I think it's becoming more widespread throughout higher education. And I think that more people are calling BS on it, especially in the faculty realm, you know, all of us with so much power, right? And things are, they're continuing on, and it's really frustrating, because I think that there could be a better solution to this, because yes, we need to be fiscally solvent, and that makes a lot of sense. Yes, grant dollars can have a role in that, and donations can have a role in that too. But the mindset that we're simply a business and need to be run like a business, and that we're all supposed to figure out what that means, I'm a little cynical about that.
That's a good one. Like you, Jen, I had to go through a list. I decided to go with recency. What's been annoying me most recently. So I was like, this wokeness stuff is really getting on my nerves. Bunch of people started emailing me, and they spell folks F-O-L-X. And I was like, I thought it was a typo. I was like, all right, that's fine. And then I'm like, the K and the X are kind of far apart on the computer keyboard. And then more and more people are doing it. And I'm like, all right. And I thought Malcolm X, you know, and like he used the X because when his ancestors were enslaved, they lost their name. And I'm like, is this something with that? And it seems kind of random. It went from this Latinx thing where people who didn't want to be gendered could say Latinx, but a lot of the people who actually speak Spanish, they don't make the consonant well phonemically. And they're like, no, that doesn't make sense. And I'm like, all right. And then I can't really seem to get a grip on where are we going with it? What's the point of that? I'm always starting to feel like it's just like being in middle school again. People are making little codes. And if you don't know the code, I was at a retreat where they kept saying DEI, DEI. And I was looking at it and I was like, I missed the first part because I was on sabbatical. And I said, well, what is that? I said, it sounds awful lot like DUI. I don't think we want to get behind that. What are you talking here? And they said, oh, no. It means diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I noticed at the same retreat, whenever certain people use those words, a subgroup of faculty would start applauding. I'm like, hey, people are applauding these words. You can spell them out. Let's pay for the whole word. Let's pay for all the letters. Don't abbreviate it. Just tell people what it is. I mean, it seems like something that was really sincere and aimed at true social justice is becoming a bit faddish. And it's just, I'm getting kind of cynical about it.
Well, Elliot, with what went with recency, I think I'm going to go with something that's probably endured or endured. Can people hear the E? Endured on that throughout time, which is the idea. It goes through all disciplines, but that when faculty members say that they want you to come and talk to them and tell you things that are going on in your life, and like they're really there, I'm kind of cynical about that. And not to say that there aren't genuine faculty members out there. It just is also like, sometimes I think they have to say that. And they don't, you don't have to say that. You can just teach. It's okay. It's fine. But it took me a long time, you know, throughout like my other master's programs, like, and even, you know, in college, just to kind of be able to pick out better who meant it and who didn't. But I think there's a lot of people saying that they're really there in certain ways, but maybe they don't really mean it. They just say it because they feel like you're paying them to say it.
Yeah. So this one is near and dear to me. And it's a source of frustration for me for a good period of time. So I've served in administrative roles about as much as I've served as a faculty member. And the frustration I found in trying to get folks from other disciplines to know and understand the requirements for counselors that are different from those in other academic disciplines and why these things are important and necessary. You know, I think about things like dispositions, right? Like other programs, necessarily, you can be academically successful and still be like an awful human and they don't care, right? Like that's not a prerequisite for you to get your degree. You can still be a terrible person and awful and whatever and academically successful and you're good. Counseling doesn't work that way, right? We need to be able to assess professional behaviors. We need to be able to assess skills. We need, these things aren't tangible, quizzable, paper writing types of things. And this pushback we get from academia sometimes about this necessity really frustrates me. It really pushes me because we're putting people in front of vulnerable individuals to help that need to be prepared to act in a way that's at the very least professional, let alone all of these other kind of characteristics that we need to critically evaluate. And I had such a hard time, I think, with that pushback and that recognition. Regardless of institution. And sometimes it's just lack of understanding. And other times I think it pushes against what academia views itself as this, you know, we're going to evaluate whether or not you have the wit, smarts, and knowledge to do your job, when in actuality, our profession is just not that simple.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Eric. That's a biggie too. I mean, we're finding it harder to dismiss people from the program. Doesn't happen a lot. But now it's like, yeah, there's all the, and we were actually told by one vice president, well, the financial aid disbursements have already been made. We can't dismiss them now. I said, oh, you can too dismiss them now. You just don't want to. I mean, yeah, a lot of pushback on that.
Yeah. What you speak about, Eric, is resonates with me too, that people don't understand what we're doing in this program, that we're doing professional development. And that might not be as economically sound as other programs, that it requires more money, it requires different kinds of resources, and we're producing different kinds of graduates who we have to have assessments on before they come in to determine whether they're a good fit. And when they're not a good fit, then we have to take action to move them out of the program. We can't just walk them through. I had a trouble with this question, although I came up with it. First, I thought meetings, and that for me was low-hanging fruit. There are way too many meetings that don't lead to anything. Often called to meetings and told a bunch of information, and you've got all these people in the same room, and you're not using them for any consultative or engaging process to move things along. You're just giving them more information. But recently, what I've landed on is program reviews, and that's been a longstanding thing for me. Luckily, I don't have to get too much engaged in those other than to sometimes supply data about things. But what I see about requests for program reviews is the material goes to whoever's asked for it, and we never hear anything back. So when somebody says, you're up for another program review, I get real cynical about it because, one, we could just make the stuff up. They're never going to check it. Secondly, we could just do whatever we wanted to in the program review, and they're never going to come back with any considerate requirement for change that we're going to have to do from it. We won't hear back from them. So obviously you can hear my cynicism in it, but I had a hard time figuring it out. And all of you touched on different things that were real important. It's sort of the sincerity of the relationship between students and faculty that Steph talked about. And then, you know, all of the other things that you spoke about as a squad. But right now, for me, it's program reviews.
And I got to say, that's a good one, too, man. 10 years as department chair, the program review requests always came about, about May 15th. Well, you know, faculty are already gone. And I can state from fact, I will not say which of the 10 years, but two of the 10 years I did make it up. And I was just like, I've had enough, y'all. Here's some numbers. You all make sense of it. And they said it's going to the, what did they say? Something? Council of Higher Learning. I'm like, really? That's a name? Did you all never go to spring break or anything? I mean, higher learning, really? We're going to go with that. All right, whatever.
All right, folks. So outside of the typical benefits academic institutions tend to give, what is a benefit they could offer that would cause you to say, okay, now we're talking, or they really know what their employees need?
Wow. Yeah. There's a couple of things I thought of, but one that really, again, it bugs me because I try to do the healthy stuff where, you know, they give us, you can earn points for being in the rec center for certain healthy activities. And it's not a huge deal to get, like if I have massage therapy once a month, my therapist will sign off on it. But the thing is, this is going back to something we talked about on a previous podcast. They have to have their own cutesy pie platform. And here I am. I'm back to Toe Licker again. I'm like, God dang it. Can't you just have a portal where we enter our stuff? But it's not intuitive and it's not even obvious. And the woman, she's kind of fed up with me and I don't blame her. I'm not rude to her, but I'm just like every year, I'm like, which button is it? But I hit that button. Oh, then I got to scroll down for what? Oh, for the oval? Why not just make another button? I don't understand. And she's like, well, it's, I'm like, back to Toe Licker, dagnabbit. So that frustrates me because I think, yeah, it's good. But, you know, for people like me who just are digitally insouciant, we're doing all the work. But, you know, we're just like, by the time we enter it in, we're exhausted by it and we don't want to go work out. That's my take.
Okay. Were you talking about like actual gym equipment? Because
I mean, where you go in and all your swipes into the rec center, you sign a thing and they can go right to this thing and you have to re-enter them through Toe Licker. And I'm like, come on.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. I wanted to make sure because when you said platform, because I really didn't have an answer for this because I have never been employed by an academic institution. So maybe like a job offer would be something that would really cause me to say, okay, now we're talking. But beyond that, I was thinking about, because Elliot, you said platform. And then I was thinking about all of the things like Blackboard and everything and just something that worked consistently and that would be easy for faculty to use throughout the university. I don't know as the platforms have cycled through the years, everyone complains about them. Everyone has the same things. But if there was one that was made that an institution could get, I think that would be cool. And it's a very simplistic answer because that's what I know.
This one was actually pretty easy for me. I think when I think about the types of things that I would want or need in my role, I would give up a portion of my salary. Right. And you can quote this and write it down somewhere for proper administrative support. Right. making sure that you have the people to handle the administrative tasks necessary to for the program to function well and for me to be able to do my job well. You know, and I've met and worked with some fantastic people who've just done their best, but I feel like sometimes the biggest selling point for me in an institution and in a program is the availability of that support to be able to do what it is you need to do. You know, it's funny because I can recall thinking about becoming a faculty member in undergrad, like how great it would be to just like go out and teach as if that's 20% of the job, right? I mean, because there's so much more to do. And I feel like if an institution really wanted me to be there, they would talk to me about the types of things that are going to help me be more effective in that role and spend less time on tasks that are just, you know, tangential and necessary, but, you know, tangential to that job, because that's really where I want to focus my time is with my students and providing them with an experience that is meaningful for them.
Along the same lines, you know, Eric, what you said really resonated with me, this idea of support staff, support people. And I think what's happening is, you, at least at our university, it might be true at others, they're being challenged by jobs that are outside of the university that are better in the market for them right now. So we had an attrition of workers, not because we laid people off, but because they went and found jobs that were better somewhere else. And because of that, we struggle with administrative support. When I struggle with this question a little bit, but I thought professional development resources. And to me, that doesn't just mean more money to go to conferences, but it means stuff built into the infrastructure, which might be graduate assistantships. It might be things that help us do our job. Particularly since Kent was awarded the prestigious R1 status without us knowing about it. Well, we did. We found out about it during COVID with the expectation that we're going to retain that status with no additional funds and no additional resources directed towards it. So for me, you know, if a university has a good package around professional resources and support, that will be the thing that says this university is concerned about taking care of their faculty.
I really appreciate everything everyone's sharing, because I think we're thinking about our own productivity, but also our quality of life in the midst of all of this. I mean, if I'm having to swipe my card every time I get on a machine and then go enter it again in Toe Liquor later, that is not increasing my quality of life. Like it's just not. We think about things, you know, minor. If you have to physically go to a campus and you have to pay for parking as a faculty member, it's like I'm having to pay the place that I work to be able to park my car. There's some things like that kind of blow your mind, because you just kind of sit there and you're like, okay, but you don't give me a free bus pass to get to campus. So like, you're not dissuading me from parking, you know, like, so I think about like, what would be some of these things like secretarial support or administrative support? Those are really important things, as is, you know, give me an incentive to use the bus or give me an incentive to actually come to campus. You know, I would hear faculty sometimes say like, I don't have a parking pass and I'm not taking the bus, so I'm not coming to campus. Like legitimately, they resented having to pay for parking on campus. And I totally get that. So it's like some of these things that are seemingly small, like if I were to, you know, if I were working in person or even working from home, I'm fully work from home right now. If they sent me a pound of Starbucks a month or something, like that would make my life, because coffee helps me to be productive, you know? Just very small things like that, that, you know, a library that has resources that you click on that link and you can get that article, as opposed to them cutting resources first from the journal subscriptions. And our profession often gets shafted first, you know, and you're waiting on interlibrary loan. I'm not even sure at my institution they even check interlibrary loan requests, but once a month, you know, it's just a really fascinating thing to think about, like, where are these small things that make it easier for me to do my job? If I'm going to campus, like, could I get a meal in the cafeteria? You know, like the cafeteria that costs about, you know, 42 cents for them to make a meal. Like, could I just go over there and get a sandwich and be able to come back and not have to pay for it? I mean, I know we're not Google and we don't have everything set out, but like, could we just have some of those things in place so that our jobs are smoother and that we're not worrying about all of these little tedious things that we need to do while we're also working 65, 70 hours a week, which is what a lot of these jobs demand. So, you know, I don't work that much now because of the way my job is structured. But when I was in a brick and mortar, I certainly did. So trying to think about what increases quality of life is really where my mind was at with this.
Now, that was a good one. And it did give me a lot of I thought about a lot of things. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, good question, Jen.
They're not parking passes, by the way. They're hunting license because there's never enough spaces. So you just have permission to hunt. It doesn't guarantee you a parking space.
That's exactly. And that says that on our site. It says you have this gives you the right to search for a space. It does not guarantee you a space. Well, my question really came out of. So I'm teaching three nights in a row. I've got group, which is they're all lovely, but group, psychopharm, and personality. So group, of course, you know, it's not much lecture. It's a lot of experiential group process stuff. Psychopharm is a lot of pharmacodynamics, pharmacokinetics. But personality, the first two theories we cover, I just find people, students just want to push things away. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. So my question was, do you find students, they're more eager to criticize new ideas before they really understand them?
I'm not sure more eager than what necessarily. However, I think they can, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. The way you were describing it doesn't necessarily sound with like if they're just pushing it away. I think a lot of times new ideas can sound silly or you're questioning it and you're trying to make it make sense and integrate it into your own brain and have it make sense. And at first, when you don't know a lot about it, you don't have a lot of information about it, it doesn't make sense. So you can criticize it. But then hopefully the criticisms are more like questions, like they're more like a chance to learn more. If it's criticism with just, you know, without the open mind, without a willingness to learn more, then that's not then that's more of a negative. But I think maybe the criticizing, even if it'd be better if they asked, you know, or thought about it differently, perhaps, but if they're still willing to listen and to hear rebuttals to those criticisms, then maybe it's not a bad thing as long as they're open to understanding eventually.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like maybe it's my face, you know, like they want to fight. They come in ready. And at first, I always felt the need to like push back and like just get into it. Now, you know, I think I have a different perspective on it now because every theories textbook I've seen, for example, will start off with none of these theories are perfect. They all have weaknesses and strengths. Okay, so picking them apart is part of this process, right? And they encourage you to grab onto something that fits with how you feel change happens and how you feel the mind works. So we have these evidence-based practices that sit out there and you can kind of grab it together and you're putting together like your personal approach to counseling in many ways. So there's going to be this kind of iterative process of tearing things apart and arguing and fighting. But I've noticed that there's a difference between a student who is trying to pick apart the theory or the material, the information, or maybe challenge the research, and those that want to get into this ego war battle with me personally or with the content personally and kind of show up this I know better stance. There's definitely a difference between those two students. And I think how you handle that is different. You know, I don't have any problems with being assertive or direct. So, you know, I like to call those things the carpet. Like, let's have the conversation. Let's pull this out. Let's, you know, let's do this. Let's go through where this comes from. So I actually get kind of excited when those things happen, whereas it used to like make me put the defenses up because I was still in a place where I felt like I needed to defend as opposed to kind of pull out that process, right? So like I try to look at things in this way that it's process over content so that we can have some of those conversations. I will say to your point, Elliot, I think it happens more often now than it used to, this kind of challenging student who wants to like assert, you know, control or have this ego battle is more common than it used to be, knowing that that's just my my own individual experience or my.
I didn't write a lot of notes on this question when I got the question. Do you find students more eager to criticize new ideas before they really understand them? My singular note was not really. That would require critical thinking skills. And that may be a little rough. You know, I listened to what Eric just said. A lot of it is like, yeah, I know those students, the ones that come in who want to argue with me because that's what they want to do. Or students who come in my case, students who have some personal experience with some particular disorder, whether through themselves or someone in their family, and they are the expert on that disorder. And then that becomes a negotiation in terms of talking about what we know about it and what they've experienced about it. But I don't see more people or less people coming in that status. And thank God for no critical thinking skills. You can just kind of tell them how it is and they soak it up.
I would say that I don't get a lot of pushback with new ideas all that often. However, I think that there are some moments where I do. So if I'm teaching, for example, cultural content in terms of cultural skills and cultural relevance, sometimes I get pushback around that kind of based on what Steph was talking about, of that disruption of homeostasis, of that's not the way I've always thought about this before, and you've given me a new idea. And because it feels more personal, because we're talking about culture, I'm going to come at you because my homeostasis has been disrupted and I haven't had time to deal with the cognitive dissonance because it's just happening right here in the moment. So I think there can be some topic dependent stuff for that that I've noticed. And it's usually most regularly, it's around cultural content. I would say more regularly, I get the ones who want to pick a fight because they didn't do the reading at all, because they think they already know what the topic is. And so they come in like guns blazing about something, and it's because they're trying to overcompensate for the fact that they didn't do the reading. And I find that to be the most irritating, because I want to say in front of the group, like, hey, so if you just crack that chapter open, you might have a little more information and not sound like such a DB at this moment, because you're really sounding like a jerk. It's hard because I won't call somebody out in quite that way. But I mean, more my style is to say, like, does somebody have another perspective on this they'd like to share, kind of thing. But by the same token, it's always very clear who didn't watch the videos. Like, we have the whole video thing going on. Eric knows this game, you know, we got these videos and they got to watch them and they got to do reading. And sometimes they'll watch a part of a video or let it play in the background, so it shows up that they did it, gives them the green check mark in Blackboard, but they didn't actually do it. But the reading, half the time, I don't think they might skim through their book, maybe, but there's like other readings and they don't download them. And I'll ask them specific content questions because I didn't assign those for nothing. And usually those are the students who get the most riled, in my opinion, not the ones who didn't do the reading because they want to show up and try to pretend like they did. See, in my day, we would hang in the back and hope we didn't get called on, not I'm going to put myself front and center and try to overcompensate. So that's been an interesting difference to notice over these last years of a generational difference between me and my students.
These are really helpful answers, because I'm noticing it, and I'm not quite sure what it's about yet, but I was aware. I was teaching Jane Lovinger's ego development theory. And I Lovinger's, she's a feminist hero of mine. And admittedly, I start with it. And I tell them, I say, I know the research on this really well. There's a test that goes with it. And this holds together about as well as any personality theory will. And people are like, not everybody, but yeah, it's like some are like, well, she said it's all about language and language has limits. So what's the point? And I'm like, you know, that sounds almost nihilistic. But I'm listening to what y'all are saying, and I'm also wondering, I think these students, many of them are feeling overwhelmed by information, and not just information, but information that seeks to coerce. And I feel like they're kind of fending off to protect some boundary, maybe. I don't really know. And I did bring this up in class. I said, I just introduced this, and unless all of you have read all the papers I put on Blackboard, which I'm guessing you didn't, you don't know the statistical bases for the hypotheses. And I'm not sure what that is about. I'm not sure yet, but I think some of it, if people are just, I don't know, exhausted and they're just fending off. Maybe it's a post-pandemic thing. Jen, I think some of it is, yeah, some people like, yeah, if I didn't do the reading, I hid in the back. I wasn't going to try to make a statement of any kind. But it's just like maybe some people double down and I'm like, well, okay, I can work with that. I, you know, but yeah, maybe people are getting bombarded and I don't know. I just don't know. I'm wondering about it. I never saw it to this extent before. There'd always be one or two folks who would be folks with a LKS, by the way. But they'd be like, yeah, you know, I got my own take on this. And I'd be like, well, let me hear it. That's cool. But and especially, Marty, what you said, you know, critical thinking, when they've read it and they're like, OK, so-and-so says this, so-and-so says this. Here's my question. I'm like, yeah, that's a good question. So, yeah, I've just been noticing it. And maybe it's just I'm getting old. Or I am old. I'm getting older. But if you just say I'm getting older, right, everyone's like, oh, you're pretending you're not old. What are you, middle-aged? I'm like, no, I'm not middle-aged. Who lives to be 122? Anyway, my point is that I think it's time to move on to the next question.
Taking a sharp left. What's something that you feel strongly about that you realize most people don't care about and that does not stop you from sharing your knowledge with others?
Got to be honest, I was pretty excited for this question. Because I've had a lot of experience with this in recent days, and I don't know why. I don't know why this has become thematic, but you know, maybe it's because I've had a lot of kids over, you know, and it's the language that I'm dealing with right now, right? So if someone is sad and experiences sadness, the word they use is depressed. I'm depressed. I have depression. There is a difference between normal emotions, things that happen, and clinically significant symptoms, right? But there's this language going on right now where that every time there's this kind of inconvenience, it's I'm not anxious. I have an anxiety disorder, right? I'm not feeling panic. I have panic attacks. And, you know, so I'm trying to separate this out, even with my own kids, and be like, okay, no, you're not depressed. You're sad. You're upset. These are really different things. And I think sometimes it's a trigger point for me because I've seen people suffering with these things and really battling these types of issues. And then to see people who, you know, of their own volition or as a result of culture or what's happened with the language or whatever, describing these kind of normative things as clinical conditions, like nonchalantly, just in conversation, is almost infuriating. So then I have to go into this speech, right? Well, there's a difference between clinical symptoms and normal, you know, and I have to do like the whole kind of thing, because if I don't, I feel like it's going to come out of my ears or something. I really don't know what to do with it. And the interesting thing is the reaction from most people is just to like smile and nod and exhale and move away and continue. Because there's something appealing or attractive or appropriate socially about having this thing to lay your kind of normative emotions into. And I try to be sensitive to the fact that I don't know everything about every person who uses these kinds of terms, and I couldn't possibly know, but some of the examples are a little infuriating, right? You know, these kind of minuscule, trivial things that would happen to spark this, I have depression, or I am depressed because. The frequency to which it happens lets me know, too, that it's not something, it's just something that's been taken way too lightly. So I like to talk about it. And then if someone does express, you know, well, you know, these are clinical things and here's why, I know a lot of great places in the area for you to get help. And here you go. But it's just, it's turned into this thing where I worry generationally and socially about the acceptability of doing that.
Great answer, Eric. You know, and I really mean that. And I went back and reread the question while you were giving your answer. And I'm like, boy, did I screw this one up. I went for old movies. That's something I care a lot about, that I will share my knowledge about old movies to people should they ask. But generally, they don't care. More recently, computers, particularly Apple products. People might want to know something about them. They don't want to know as much as I have to share to them about them. That's something I'm passionate about. But you went with the big ticket societal issue. I went with something very, base.
Well, funny enough, I got a range. Like, I feel like I'm telling people stuff all the time. They don't care. They're like, just stop, you know? And it ranges from, you know, trying to inform people culturally when they're speaking so much biased nonsense, I can't stand it anymore, and wanting people to have more information, to justice issues, to people telling me they're going on vacation to Denver or some other place I've lived and loved and needing to tell them every little thing about what happens in Denver and how it's changed. And I heard it's different now that more Californians and Texans live there. And I left there in this amount of time. The same thing with like the inner workings of airlines and airline travel. Like, I think everyone needs to know every airport code and which upgrades are the best and which flights you'll most likely get an upgrade on which days of the week. Nobody cares. Most people are just buying a damn ticket and that is the end of it. But for some reason, you know, somebody tells me in the grocery store, oh, I'm thinking about cooking zucchini. I really like it, but I've never cooked it before. Those poor people just walked away with a minimum of 4 recipes from me because I cannot stop myself. So I feel like I should be on one of those progressive commercials about how to not become your parents, because I am totally that person who thinks I'm being helpful to the outside world. And I don't think they care. I get enjoyment out of this, but, you know, I do not think most people care about any of this information. And it ranges in terms of passion, obviously, but I can be just as passionate about somebody's trip to Denver as I can be about, please do not say that about low-income people, because it's abjectly wrong. So
can I have those recipes, please?
Yeah. Hello. I mean, this is why this show goes on too long, is because I try to truncate my stories, but like sometimes I just have to tell y'all a story, you know.
It's all a beautiful flow, Dr. Cook. Now, these are great answers, and I'm the same. I kind of resonate with all of them because, yeah, I'm just like, wow. Some of it starts professionally, like when I hear if I'm interviewing people for a potential internship site, and I hear them mention, oh yeah, the chemical imbalance in brain, I'm like, whoa, everybody sit down, I got something to tell you. We falsified that multiple times since the 1990s, and I assume you knew that. But you know, and I try not to get on a high horse, but when I realize I'm trying not to, too late. And it's the same thing. One of my students was like, Dr. I, do you like the X-Files? I'm like, oh, I love the X-Files. Yeah, my wife and I watch them all the time. And they're like, yeah. And this was an amateur magician. And he said, how about the Great Malini? Wasn't that a good one? I said, yeah, but did you know that it was drawn off of an actual magician from the late 19th, early 20th century called Max Malini, who was kind of a pudgy, short-fingered fellow who just blew people away with it. And he's like, gotta go, doctor. I got a class. It's fine. I always tell people I will try to infect them with my enthusiasm like a fungus, but if it doesn't take, it doesn't take.
I get the same thing, Elliot, that slow back away of like, well, thanks so much for that. I got to take off now. Got to get to the next thing. And you're like, oh, you know, you just, the head just starts to drop where you're like, I think I went too far.
I've gotten better though. I don't chase them down the hall and go, yeah. But whoa, whoa.
No. Okay. Yeah. Cause like, this was a lot of fun actually to hear all of this. And the situation that sparked this question for me gives me an answer more on par with Marty's, which, yeah, it makes me, after hearing Eric's answer, feel about as deep as a parking lot. So for me, it is totally music connections. It's like influences or maybe even trivia. So one that I didn't think of coming up with an answer for this, in the ways that I've tortured Mike at times for, I think, the first 5 years of our relationship, every time Oingo Boingo came on, I was like, what famous composer came from this band? And I mean, he's a Simpsons fan. So like, I felt like he would know that. But anyway, it's Danny Elfman, by the way, for anyone who needed to know. Oh, this feels so good to share all of this. This is what I do. So like another way that I had Mike captive, we were driving somewhere and I was going through point by point how Dua Lipa's Don't Start Now is directly related to Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. And like multiple ways, I'm like, look, look, this is totally referencing this. Now, this actual question, this actual whole thing kind of came up. And I, these were just examples from my life before. But what really sparked this was I get, you know, on Spotify, they'll do the Discover Weekly. And it's awesome. I get to hear things that I would never select myself. And all of a sudden, this one song came on by someone, Labi Siffra. I'm not sure if it's Siffra or Siffre, but it's called I Got The. And it's a 6.5 minute track. After about 2 minutes, it switches up and it goes, and I'm like, what? And I, my name is, and I was like, oh my God, that's a sample from Eminem. And I couldn't believe it. And it was so cool. And it just made me so excited. And I sent it, that I sent this Labi Siffra track to like 3 separate friend groups, just being like, just listen to it, because I thought it was at least accessible enough that everyone would get it. Like, everyone's like, it sort of sounds familiar, and nobody even asked like what it was or anything. And I'm still just really excited. And so I appreciate this question coming up in the queue for tonight, because I feel much better now that I got to say all that.
I love your connection to music, because yes, I listen to Stephen King's radio station out of Bangor, WKIT, and there's this guy on Sunday, Fred Zeppelin, awesome show. And he was playing a Kid Rock song, and I'm like, oh, come on, man, he's ripping off Werewolves of London. Listen, bum bum, baga bunk bung, baga bunk bunk. I'm like, and he's like, no, you're right, my man. My mistake. I should have played Warren Zevon. I love that guy. Anyway, some people get it.
And I didn't even mention music. I want to demonstrate that I had restraint during my answer, because I didn't even get into music. I didn't get into 90s, 80s, and 70s TV shows. 2 other topics I love to tell people random facts about that they don't care. But anyway, so since I showed restraint, I got to jump in.
You're really going to have to ask my family what are the things that I'm passionate about that I won't shut up about. They probably are the best critics. I can't see it through my own eyes. I've got to hear it from other people.
My favorite part of that whole interchange was Jen starting with, I showed restraint, telling you the thing she showed restraint about, and then repeating, I showed restraint. So she got to it anyway, right?
She's one of my heroes. I just love the way she slipped that in there.
Y'all so sweet.
All right. Well, I guess I have the final question, full question for the night. How do you draw the line when it's time to fight or argue and time to walk away?
For me, it's my lines move far, far away from each other, that I am much more happier to walk away and much more happier to kind of let it lie. You know, if and we'll go to students. I don't get into a lot of arguments with students. I just don't. But should they come up with something that they want to argue about, I'll go, okay, you know, and try and diffuse it before it turns into an argument. And I guess you would call that walking away, but I've moved away from the need to have to win on those kind of things, on a lot of things. So when big changes come around in program or university, it's like, okay, now there might be people who are more passionate about wanting to fight those issues. Not me, not where I'm at, not what I'm doing. So those lines have gotten really further apart, and I'm more likely to just let it go. Because half the time the reality doesn't come that they're threatening, and the other half the time I'm not invested in it. So
I'm honestly not one to really argue very much. I'll discuss passionately, and especially if there's a give and take exchange happening. But I'm not one to get in an argument really all that much. That's pretty rare for me. I think mainly because sort of what Marty's talking about is like, I've gotten to the point where does this really matter? Like I think I have a better filter of like, can I influence any kind of change here? How much is it going to matter in the long term? And is there a chance it's just going to change to something else again in the next 20 minutes? Because I think that's what a lot of us have probably started to learn in higher ed, is that, you know, some things seem to be the slowest wheels ever to move. And then other things, they seem to just keep changing back and forth into something else, sort of like the APA manual, you know? It's like,
what a piece of crap that is. But that's another pop. I'm sorry.
Right. We'll be back with two spaces after the period, any version now, you know, because that's what seems to happen. So I would say that I do a whole lot more walking away. But, you know, there are some times where I get hot, but it takes a lot to truly get me angry. And typically I'm not going to engage when I'm that angry unless I have to, because that's the moment where it has to come forth. But I think that those moments are pretty far and few between, because I'm not interested in going there. And by nature, I'm not angry. Am I cynical? Yes. Do I like to be sarcastic? Absolutely. Is a good bitch session sometimes cathartic? Yeah, sure is. But in terms of sort of living my life in that, like, kind of let's argue and let's fight it out, it's got to really be worth it.
Yeah, I like that. And I know, Eric, after fight, you put in parentheses argue. But for me, I have to kind of draw from my experience with physical fights, the majority of which I have lost colossally, which my temperament, I got a crusader in there. Oh, man, he loves to start sharpening that sword. He's like, oh, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Let's do it. But the older I get, I'm like, yeah, you know, what I've learned, and again, whether it's a physical issue or a bureaucratic fight, I want to know, what are the stakes? Who are the stakeholders? And what are the odds? I really want to know that. If the stakeholders are students, more often than not, I'll go to the mat. And I think, like everyone here, that's really the best part of my day, is working with the students, you know. But if I look at it and I'm like, oh, we're in an executive retreat, the whole agenda has been set by the administration, faculty were not consulted, anything that comes up there, I'm going to be like, well, this is not, especially since I got this long COVID, I have to really decide. One of my former colleagues used to say, well, is that a hill you want to die on? And I kind of like that phrase, because it's like, yeah, you got to make choices, and I have to make those choices. I'm getting better as I get older, but I'm also like, yeah, I want to know, what are the stakes? What are the stakeholders? Who are the stakeholders? And what are the odds? I'll tell you one, though. Here's a story. I was in a retreat and we were looking at mission statements, and they were saying they wanted to say, oh, well, we are an anchor and a beacon university. And I said, are we wed to that language? And they're like, why? I said, well, anchor stops things from moving. I don't associate that with a university. And a beacon warns people away. I said, what are you telling people? Yeah, sail your little ship of aspirations up to our light and we'll crash it on the rocks of our curricula. I don't even know what you're talking about. And they're like, apparently no one else had ever thought of this. So in moments like that, I'm like, well, okay, it's good to provide a different perspective, but I still don't think I'm going to win that one either, as logical as it seems to me and several others who were laughing in the room.
Yeah, I don't consider myself to be like a real fighter in the sense of arguing just for the sake of arguing. If I'm find myself in what would be maybe categorized as an argument, for me, it's either because I think that we're having a discussion, maybe a passionate discussion, but, you know, at a certain point, it's like, are we working to understand each other better? And that's a question. If it's just kind of just the same things being said, once it starts going around and around, it's like, no. And I'm not necessarily talking about in an academic setting or anything. I'm being pretty general here because I don't have the same type of relationships to draw upon every day in those kind of situations. In general, there's just other things I'd rather be doing with my time and energy. But I will try to engage perhaps to see if there's like a reasonable way to communicate. And maybe there's something I'm missing. And so I want to figure that out. And if it's either there's something else I can learn. Oh, okay. You know, but the only time I can think of myself, you know, when I really fought for something was more on a personal level where I think it was just more of a, there was no question that some negligence had occurred, and I just wasn't going to be able to sit back and just be like, oh, okay, that's cool that happened. And, you know, instead of just saying, okay, we just move on, I was like, no, this is a time where it's worth putting some time and energy into a legitimate type of fight per se. And I think it comes down to just feeling like I was true to myself, I think, and that might translate to more situations. That's just the big one that kind of comes out. Did I feel like I was being fair to myself? And most of the time, I think like what everyone else is saying, yeah, you're being more fair to yourself if you just stop and walk away.
I don't know. Maybe it's an age thing for me. I haven't really put a finger on what exactly it is. But I found that the little things that don't bother me or just kind of irked me earlier, I've kind of fallen off. Like I can just kind of let those go. But the bigger things I find myself being more vocal about now. Like I need to be heard on whatever this is. Not necessarily just for change, that I need you to understand what my perspective is if I am to hear yours. Right. There needs to be some reciprocity. So hearing that from everybody was really actually helpful for me, you know, because I've been in a couple of situations lately where I feel like, OK, I've been put on the spot for an opinion and given it to unhappy ears. And, you know, I've actually given the disclaimer, you probably don't want to hear this from me. This is probably not a good idea for you. But it's interesting how I've kind of walked into that. I kind of walked into this place where I feel like I've shifted and I've noticed the shift that, I've become more vocal. And I walked into the counseling profession. I had a real appreciation for it because my inclination was always to listen and not speak. So it was an easy transition for me into this type of career. And some parts of me, I feel like, are now walking in the other direction. But it's interesting, and I appreciate hearing everybody's response. It's really cool.
Well, that's the round of questions that we had. We've got one final question, which is the final shot question. And I have had lots of dreams of my passing. And, you know, some of them have been wake-up calls for maybe I need to, but it's generally stress-related. Let's just put it that way. It's generally there's too much going on right now, and so it comes out in my dream that way. But the question for tonight is, what is your dream of your perfect death scenario?
So like what we hope will happen?
Yeah. What would be the perfect scenario for you?
For me, it's just go to bed and don't wake up.
Yeah, for me, nothing too messy, please.
I actually vacillate between some cool, like super cool grand act that's really dramatic when I know it's my time. Or just the way Jen said.
Yeah, I don't know. A climactic fight to the end for, world peace or something. I don't know. Or, in my sleep, peacefully. Just either one is fine.
I envision myself being 122 and lying in bed, surrounded by friends and family, and like lots of choir music. And I don't mean traditional religious choir music. I'm talking about Polyphonic Spree and Follow the Day. I mean, I kind of want to go with that kind of joy and engagement and people around me laughing and having a good time. That would be my perfect scenario.
Before you end, I'm just going to throw this out there. I've had, like you, dreams of my passing. I'm pretty sure I've got until Halloween 2056. That's the date. And the Halloween part, I'm really freaking old, so I can squeeze it out. But Houdini was my childhood hero. And I'm like, yeah, let's do a Houdini. That's fine. So I'm just going to, I'm stating it publicly so that we can see, hey, let's find out. Because if I die on Halloween 2056, you know, that one or two people who remembered this podcast that we did would be like, oh, that fellow was right. There you go.
And if it follows Houdini, they'll hold seances for you for about 26 years and then give up.
Exactly. I love it.
Well, those of you listeners might contemplate the idea of your perfect death scenario. Actually, I had a minister do a dissertation on ministers' perfect death scenarios, how they viewed passing away would be like. So that's sort of where the question came from, too. Thanks to the firing squad, Jen, Eric, Stephanie, and Elliot. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on thepodtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. Our theme music is from an Aja Quad, Real Swing Chet. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, aim, fire.